Hey everyone, welcome to our Davenant Shorts, where we're talking to Davenant Hall lecturers, professors, staff, faculty, all that fun stuff about their courses in this upcoming Trinity term, which runs from April 8th to June 15th, and registration ends March 29th. So by the time this episode comes out, you'll have about a week and a half before registration closes. You're going to want to register for this course as soon as you possibly can. And this course is Philosophy as a Way of Life. We have Dr. Joe Minich, and you might recall his name because we've had him on before. Actually, about a year ago around this time, we had him on for his Lexham Press book, The Bulwarks of Unbelief, how atheism basically was made possible. So thanks for coming back on the show for a little mini interview, Dr. Minich.
Well, thanks for having me.
This will be fun. So if people hadn't listened to your previous episode with us, just introduce yourself, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, and then especially so how you became a Davenant Hall lecturer.
Yeah, my name is Joe Minich. I suppose my background is a little bit all over the place, a little bit of history, a little bit of theology. The PhD is technically in the humanities, though philosophy heavy. And so I guess I'm closest to being a philosopher, I suppose, by trade.
Makes sense for this course. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's effectively my background. Been all over, not just kind of academically, but ecclesiastically, and lived in a good handful of spots in the nation. And so I'm trying in some sense to draw from all of that to teach my students. And I suppose it is being something of an idiosyncratic hodgepodge of a person and intellectual that lands me at Davenant, the peculiar network of intellectuals and pastors and professionals that made up the original cohort of Davenant, and out of which this institution, Davenant Hall, has grown. Of course, tethered, you know, to the Reformed confessions and tradition, nevertheless, a kind of interesting group of fellows that I'm just really privileged to work with. And so my relationship to Davenant overall is really as old as the institution. I suppose I knew some of the folks that founded it, and I was kind of part of their little army of friends that they put together organically at the very beginning. And as I was going through my master's and my PhD and such, it became the case that it was looking more and more like I might put my hat in with Davenant and help, you know, help that team as opposed to go into a more traditional academic route and that sort of thing. And so when Davenant Hall basically was founded and cultivated just a couple of years ago, I was one of the original, kind of the original faculty, and have since taken on full-time responsibilities with Davenant, doing teaching for Davenant Hall, but then a bunch of things on the residential side of things over here. I'm actually coming from Davenant House, where we host student groups and other events that Davenant does. And, you know, I've had my hands in the press and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I guess I've been here since the beginning, and it's turned into a full-time position in the last year, which I'm just very excited about. And it's a great gig.
There you go. Yeah. So students are interested in seeing what Davenant House actually looks like. If you look right over his shoulders, you get to see what Davenant Hall actually looks like, or at least the Davenant House actually looks like.
Yep.
So special little treat for our YouTube audience.
Yep.
Exactly. So speaking about Davenant Hall, what makes Davenant Hall unique, since you've been there basically since the beginning? What makes it unique amidst just the scores, the scads of options within the theological, educational, higher theological training?
Yeah, Davenant Hall is a fascinating institution to me. And I think a lot of what makes it unique is that, on the one hand, like, I went to seminary, I went to RTS in DC, had an absolutely wonderful experience. I don't come at this from somebody who's, like, you know, critical of seminary in principle.
No,
or
you're
something
not poo-pooing
like
other theological institutions.
Yeah, no, not at all. And nevertheless, seminaries have as their reason for being typically the training of ministers.
Yep.
Often there's people like myself who go to seminary and they're not trying to become a minister, but you can learn a lot doing that, as I learned a lot. Davenant, I think it's more principial that what we're doing here really is trying to take the tradition and apply it to people wherever they're coming from. So you get a lot of lay people. You get people that have already been to seminary who want to supplement that education, pastors and elders and all that sort of thing, who are coming to engage pieces of the tradition and pieces of knowledge that they're interested in for the sake of bringing it back to the peculiar vocations that they have. And so we've had people from already all over the world, an enormous amount of men, an enormous amount of women, an enormous amount of clergy, an enormous amount of laity. And it really is, and then the environment from within which we're learning as well, I'd say is a little more seminar-like and open-ended, in the sense that while our teaching is rooted in the and grounded in the Reformed confessions and in the Protestant tradition, the goal is not so much to kind of produce copiers, as it were, of that tradition. It's to internalize that tradition and then take it and to sort of take it and inflect it creatively. I don't mean that in any sort of loosey-goosey way. But part of the environment you get there, or part of the thing that cultivates that, is that even among the faculty, we're kind of a pan-Protestant confessional organization, in the sense that, you've got Anglicans and Presbyterians and Baptists, and we can even have Lutherans around here and get along, as long as they'll like us,
Yeah, as long as they keep us.
Exactly. And so, we're coming from a good handful of angles and are already used to being in dialogue with each other, rooted in a kind of rich common heritage, but already a bit differently inflected in each of us. And then we each have different convictions about all the, contemporary hot takes about things. And
Sure.
so the professors, in a sense, are already in a rich conversation, and you invite the students into that. And that's really what it's meant to be, is an incubator of that kind of vibe, if you will, so that we can send our students out to really aid the church, to be big in imagination, but also to have a deeper, ha also be deeply rooted in the riches that we share, in one sense, and then take it back to their own context.
Yeah, that's good. So, more focused specifically on your course, the course has a lofty name, Philosophy as a Way of Life. So, can you describe what the course is going to be talking about? Because life is a big topic.
So, philosophy as a way of life, for those with ears to hear, kind of pings a resurgence movement that is often associated with the name Pierre Hadot. And effectively, what it looks at is that we all kind of hear about philosophy in our undergraduate courses, and it's kind of like an engineer brain, logic, chopping,
Yeah.
solving kind of apparatus that you develop to
Or the guy
figure out
who's
why
too
you're
smart
not
for
in
his
the
own good and he
matrix.
ends up working at Starbucks and he just has all these arguments all the time.
And you're trying to, figure out how you're not in the matrix or something like
Yeah,
that.
exactly.
The origin of philosophy, and this was kind of Hadot's contribution to the history of philosophy. The origin of philosophy, it was very often conceived that on the one hand, we are in philosophy after the attempt to grab, as it were, the unity of all the things out there in the mind, to hold in ourselves the unity of the cosmos, in a way. What is the most singular and high way we can look at everything? Philosophy has always had that kind of gaze. But philosophy was always an attempt of a community to practice the whole ordering of the self around that unity. And so it's not just a unified glance at the cosmos pulled over into the mind in such a way that I could know, but the patterning of my whole life and my whole self after that unity, so that that unity comes from both angles. And often the practices, kind of like a, you could almost think of a philosophical school that Paul might be engaging in Acts, as a kind of dojo. The practices, as it were, are meant to train you, in a sense, to hold the world in the way that a particular philosophy is after. And it's for this reason that in the period of antiquity and late antiquity, it was not uncommon for Jews and for Christians, by philosophers, by people commenting in the Mediterranean world, to be seen as a philosophical people, or in the case of the Jews, as a nation of philosophers, because the perception was, here's a community that's very singularly ordered around something, over around a kind of monotheistic conception of God and the practices around that. And that manifested very philosophically. And so what we do in this course is kind of go through the history of philosophy, you might say, and look at attempts to construct philosophy in that manner. What the unity of things, and then how do we pattern ourselves around it? And so we kind of go through like the pre-Socratics and the Socratics, And one of the fun things that we get to do in this course is treat Jesus and Paul as kind of stepping stones in a real world history of philosophy. So how does, by that definition of philosophy, how does Jesus ring as a philosopher? How does Paul ring as a philosopher? And of course, we're this through Jonathan Pennington and
I was
others.
about to bring up his book that Jesus is philosopher.
And we draw on his book on Sermon on the Mount a bit in the course, and
There's
it's
another one
like
on Paul and the Giants of Philosophy,
that's
too.
also in the course. That Paul and the Giants of Philosophy is also a reading in the course. And exactly what you're seeing in New Testament studies and Second Temple studies and these sorts of things these days is that people are aware that this is a discourse that is being pinged in various places in the New Testament. And some of the New Testament content shines a bit when you read them within that larger context in this way. And as Pennington and others have pointed out, it was very, very common both in the early church and those outside the early church to see Jesus as a philosopher of sorts. Justin can don the philosopher's robe without a crisis of identity in the second century. But I think recovering that more ancient rather than community college vision of philosophy we have today helps you understand what's going on there, and why those identities in a sense aren't in conflict.
Yeah, I mean, even the Epicureans and Stoics looked at Paul in the book of Acts. It's like, this dude has a philosophy we've never heard about. So they treat him much like a philosopher as well.
Yep, exactly. That's right.
So you've already talked about two books. You'll be engaging this and it's kind of general topics. But as you know, students, and especially I think those who are coming into Davenant, are like, hey, Dr. Minnick, what am I going to be reading in this course? Like, what am I going to be engaging with? Like, tease me a little bit. What am I going to be reading in this course?
So the two texts that I get, there's a handful of them. Socrates and Other Saints is an interesting book, and there's again Pennington and this Paul stuff. There's a handful of texts that are fascinating. Two that you'll be reading that I find fascinating are Sharpe and Urey's Philosophy as a Way of Life, which is really a history of the concept of philosophy as a way of life from the ancient to modern times, kind of modern parodies of philosophy as a way of life. And that text is unique. I don't think there's any other text. There's many books. I think Joshua Jip just published a book, Christian Philosophy as a Way of Life. Philosophy as a way of life as a theme is being recovered remarkably in the last decade. And we're going to see more and more books with that in the title. This book is unique in that it's really, as far as I am aware, the only real historical survey of that motif,
Interesting.
so that you're kind of able to see the evidence for looking at it that way, the discussion of those who framed it that way, and the various little disputes there. But seeing how smoothly that helps you access, seeing the way in which that gives you a history of philosophy is very, very interesting, and the continuity, in a sense, of the philosophical project. And then we read Stephen R.L. Clarke's Ancient Mediterranean Philosophy. And if nothing else, just introducing students to the writings of Stephen R.L. Clarke is so exciting to me because he's one of these philosophers that most people in the Protestant world don't read, though I think he is technically a Protestant. But he is one of these guys who really understands the ancient mind. He knows several piles of literature that are very rarely known, I'd say, maybe in our circles. And he's able to draw a map of kind of the world of mythos to logos. What is it that makes philosophy philosophy as opposed to the grammar of the myths? And then speak about the development of philosophy all the way into the late antique period and do it with such precision and a comprehensiveness of knowledge that just being introduced to Stephen R.L. Clarke as a writer is something I love to give to students because he is, in my judgment, just one of the most excellent writers and one of the most excellent thinkers, and opens the mind up, I think, to ways of putting everything together that just in an exciting manner. So Stephen R.L. Clarke is just absolutely a fantastic read, and I love introducing students to him and taking them through his work.
So students are salivating at this, and you're excited to teach this. But as I've talked to each one of the dominant lecturers as we conclude, the goal is not just so much to, of course, it is part to just open up their brains and then insert some information, close back their brains, and then send them off on their way. You want to inform them, but also form them into a certain type of person. So what? What's your hope of this course and how it forms and shapes your students after taking it?
Yeah, and in some sense, probably more than any other course, there's a little bit of an underhanded pitch for this particular one, because the whole point of taking this approach to philosophy as a way of life is to see that the task that we're involved in is just that. It's a posture of the whole self toward the whole of things. And what you want students to walk away with is actually as full removal from an ideological or kind of engineer brain approach to what philosophy is, and that sense that there's the project of philosophy involves the engagement of the whole human and the whole of your life, the whole of your experiences, the whole of your story, and then the engagement with the whole story in a sense of the world and the structure of the world, and to put those together in such a way that's actually illuminating and posturing of your act. And in one sense, one of the ways you get that is just to engage different ways people have done that, imagined what that project might look like. And so in some sense, it's the most it sounds a bit theoretical, I suppose, but in some ways it's almost kind of pre that's almost prepackaged practical. Because the motif itself is meant to treat philosophy as much a content as a set of exercises, a way of exercising the whole self and the world. And so really just cultivating students who have that as a vision for themselves and who have a sense of wonder about what it means to look, grow in knowledge, and to have a sense of the whole of things, I think is just crucial, especially in an era where I think ideas really do. We live in such an era of tribal knowledges. We live in such an era of kind of learning things to get into the debates. And you lose that primal childlike contact. If Christ, this isn't what Christ means when he says,
Ideas are no
"Love
longer
others."
communal. Ideas are the things that separate us from each other.
Yep. So it's like Christ says you have to become a child to enter the kingdom of heaven. And I'm not. This is not exactly what Christ was talking about. But there's a philosophical equivalent, which is you also have to become a little bit like a child to become a great philosopher. And philosophy as a way of life is recapturing that contact with things by the means of wonder, I think, that makes each person to be the best philosopher, to engage in the project of philosophy in the best way they can.
So if this interests any students, those who are either looking for continuing education or to dip their toes in, audit a course, or become a full-time student, we have a coupon code that Devonett Hall has given to us for all of our listeners. It's GGG Trinity 24. And if you use that, you get $25 off your first course. You're a first-time student, you get your first $25 off. So it's, I think it's effectively 10, it's like 7 to 10% off, depending on what kind of student you become at Devonett Hall. So I would very much encourage, we'll have that in our show notes, but thank you, Dr. Minnick, for coming on and talking about your course, and excited to see people take this course and become philosophers of life.
All right. Thanks so much.